So here we are again. People in Yemen who have endured years of horrific suffering, widely documented by the UN and Amnesty and others, have now been left without any kind of UN mechanism to either document or investigate those violations. So we all know that the UN system has failed them, allowing for a situation where bullying and bribing, corruption of the system has won the day. Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies shamelessly and aggressively lobbied states throughout their capital city and got rid of the Group of Eminent Experts, or GEE.
Yemen is starving to death. Almost every minute, a Yemeni child is dying of starvation. The impoverished country is also experiencing the worst cholera outbreak in recorded history. Against such a backdrop, the self-proclaimed champion of human rights has done nothing to stop this humanitarian tragedy. On the contrary, it's still giving military and intelligence support to Saudi Arabia and its cronies. Even congressional efforts have failed to prevent the White House from supporting the coalition.
It is long past overdue that Congress remove U.S. forces from Yemen, as recent circumstances only confirm. Today we have the chance to remedy our course of action and to do what the Constitution and justice demand. The situation in Yemen is dire.
When Joe Biden came to office, he vowed to end the war.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But more than 1 year into his presidency, the U.S. keeps selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which keeps using them in its indiscriminate attacks. Surprisingly enough, the Biden administration approved a $650 million weapons sale to Saudi Arabia, which consisted of 280 AIM-120C air-to-air missiles that will be launched from Saudi Arabia's fighter jets. While described as defensive in nature, the sale angered even some Democrats, who say the non-stop flow of weapons from the U.S., regardless of their categorization, will only fuel the conflict. In other words, despite his anti-Saudi rhetoric, Biden has adhered, like his predecessors, to the traditional role of America in the region, following the preferences of the Saudi kingdom and the UAE and selling them more and more weapons. Upon the outbreak of the war, then-President Barack Obama declared that he had authorized U.S. forces to provide logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis in their military intervention in Yemen, establishing a joint planning cell with Saudi Arabia. Needless to say, under Donald Trump, the U.S. continued its support to the coalition. Until November 2018, that support included refueling Saudi warplanes that dropped bombs on Yemeni civilians, including children. The Trump administration ended the practice after increased pressure from activists and lawmakers about Riyadh's brutal conduct in the war.
Today we tell the despotic regime in Saudi Arabia that we will not be part of their military adventurism. And today, maybe in the most profound way, 45 years ago, the War Powers Act was passed. 45 years ago. Today, for the first time, we are going to go forward utilizing that legislation and tell the President of the United States and any president, Democrat or Republican, that the constitutional responsibility for making war rests with the United States Congress, not the White House. Let us pass this resolution.
But Washington continues to provide logistical and intelligence support for the Saudis and plans to sell them billions in advanced weapons like precision-guided missiles. In 2019, Trump even vetoed a bipartisan bill which would have ended U.S. support for the Saudi-led military intervention.
So here we are asserting Congress's long-established responsibility in the oversight of our use of military force, and also limiting Americans' engagement in this war, which has gone on far too long. I think we all agree. It's so sad. The president must sign this legislation. We're so proud of the bipartisan support, bicameral legislation that we will sending him to advance a peaceful, enduring solution to a horrific humanitarian crisis.
In the words of U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, as long as we're providing intelligence sharing, spare parts, maintenance transfers, selling weapons, regardless if they're offensive or defensive in nature, or so-called offensive or defensive, we're going to see more violence. Since the beginning of the Yemen war, the Saudi-led coalition has been pounding the country with bombs, many of them supplied by the UK. In fact, London immediately expressed strong support for the Saudi-led campaign. The war saw sales of UK bombs for 2015 increase from £9 million to over £1 billion in 3 months. In September 2016, then UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson refused to block UK arms sales to Riyadh, arguing there was no clear evidence of breaches of international humanitarian law by the kingdom in the war in Yemen, and that it would be best for Saudi Arabia to investigate itself. According to the UK campaign group Campaign Against Arms Trade, BAE Systems has sold £17.6 billion worth of arms and military services to the Saudi dictatorship since 2015.
In fact, we sold £1.4 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia in 3 months last year, including bombs and missiles that could be used in Yemen. Given everything we know about the appalling humanitarian cost of this war, with innocent civilians caught between the Saudi coalition and the Houthi rebels, why does the Prime Minister think it's right to be selling these weapons?
In April 2019, The Guardian revealed more than 40 Saudi officers had been trained at prestigious British military colleges since the start of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. While the World Food Programme warns it cannot feed Yemenis properly because of funding shortfalls, the UK slashed its humanitarian aid to Yemen by half in 2021. All in all, both the US and the UK have been providing, arming, refueling and servicing Saudi warplanes, which have routinely struck weddings, funerals, apartments, markets and other civilian targets. Although the two countries have enjoyed exemption from accountability, that doesn't change the reality on the ground. They are both accomplices to war crimes and have blood of innocent people on their hands. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
There is no suppression in Islam. In Islam, there is liberty for all strata of society, for women, men, for white and blacks, for everyone. From now on, men should be afraid of themselves, not of the government. They should be afraid lest they do wrong. February 1st, 1980.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio, and I'm your host Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini in one of his speeches has said that our great Islamic revolution is first and foremost a moral, spiritual revolution before being a social, political one. Now, in this part of his speech, He's referring to the Islamic perspective of this revolution. Generally, when we look at the revolutions in the whole world, they have the social political aspect in it, and it is highlighted that it is a social political revolution, whereas in the Islamic revolution, when we talk about the Islam and the revolution that happened in the Islamic Republic of Iran, that was the moral spiritual revolution, because Islam has come to take people towards perfection. Islam is the whole set of we can say like the life, and it gives us the rules and laws to follow in order to become perfect in our lives. One of the aspects, or one of the subtitles within the Islamic revolution, is the socio-political aspect. It has its own religious aspect, it has its political aspect, social aspect, individual aspect. So all these things that we look, economical aspect as well. So all these things that we look, it shows us that we cannot deal with all these aspects differently or individually. Rather, when we look at the Islamic revolution, it is a set of everything. It is a complete set, and it has all things within it. Therefore, we cannot just separate one aspect of the revolution. Therefore, Imam is saying that the Islamic revolution is the first and foremost a moral spiritual revolution, and this moral spiritual revolution will take us morally, spiritually, to the peaks and the heights, and that's what Islam wants us to be. Islam wants us to be at the highest peak of the moral and spiritual level, and this moral and spiritual level can be gained by an Islamic system. Therefore, this revolution has strived for this system, and whoever comes under the umbrella of this system, whoever lives under this kind of system, he will definitely reach to the highest peaks of the moral and spirituality. So therefore, this is what Imam Khomeini is talking about. And this revolution is definitely a moral and spiritual revolution.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A study finds that average Briton produces more carbon in 2 days than a Congolese person does in an entire year. We now present you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled, West Accused of Climate Hypocrisy as Emissions Dwarf Those of Poor Countries. According to an analysis by the Center for Global Development, in the first 2 days of January, the average Briton was already responsible for more carbon dioxide emissions than someone from the Democratic Republic of Congo would produce in an entire year. The study, which highlights the vast energy inequality between rich and poor countries, found that each Briton produces 200 times the climate emissions of the average Congolese person, with people in the United States producing 585 times as much. It found by the end of January, the carbon emitted by someone living in the United Kingdom will surpass the annual emissions of citizens of 30 low and middle income countries. Ewan Ritchie, a policy analyst at the Center for Global Development Europe, said his work was prompted by the climate hypocrisy of Western countries, including the United Kingdom and the United States, that have pledged to stop aid funding to fossil fuel projects in developing states. Ewan Ritchie said, at COP26, there was lots of hand-wringing by rich countries about the extent to which aid and other development finance should finance fossil fuels in poorer countries. The hypocrisy of this caught my attention. Ewan Ritchie noted, our analysis shows that in just a few days, the average person in the United Kingdom produces more climate emissions than people in many low-income countries do in an entire year. It would be a cruel irony if the countries that have least contributed to this problem won't be able to have access to energy infrastructure. Several countries, including some developing countries and finance institutions, have signed up to a pledge to end public support for international fossil fuel projects. The same countries will be able to continue to develop fossil fuels at home. The United States has at least 24 pending fossil fuel projects, representing more than 1.6 gigatons of potential greenhouse gas emissions, while the United Kingdom is licensing new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. The Center for Global Development research used World Bank data of per capita carbon emissions for each country spread out over a year to calculate the point at which a British or an American citizen's energy use surpassed that of someone living in low or middle income country. About 940 million people, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, do not have access to electricity. African leaders, including President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria, who has committed Nigeria to net zero emissions by 2060, and Lazarus Chakwera, the President of Malawi, have spoken out about their country's need to transition to net zero emissions via natural gas. The Energy for Growth Hub, an international research network, estimates that if 48 countries in Africa, excluding South Africa and several North African nations, tripled their electricity consumption through use of natural gas, the resulting carbon emissions would be less than 1% of the global total. Vijaya Ramachandran, the Director of Energy and Development at the Breakthrough Institute in Berkeley, California, argues that blanket bans on fossil fuel projects in poor countries are colonial and will entrench poverty while doing little to reduce the world's carbon dioxide emissions. She said, It's very easy for rich countries to impose fossil fuel financing bans on poor countries, while at the same time increasing their own consumption of fossil fuels. She added, "It's rank hypocrisy, and it's devastating for poor countries as they need a wide range of energy to fuel development." She noted, "It's well known renewable energy is intermittent and needs to be backed up by other sources of energy. Telling African countries they just need solar power is completely hypocritical and colonial." Rose Mutiso, the Research Director of Energy for Growth Hub, said the Center for Global Development Research should be used to inform the debate over responsibility for the climate crisis. Rose Mutiso, who is a Kenyan, said, "Solving the climate crisis in the medium term is the responsibility of high-emitting countries, not only because they caused the problem in the first place, but logically, it's where high emissions are concentrated." She said, "The video gaming industry in California is using more energy than entire African countries. There's this idea that in California we can't live without video games or air conditioning, but we are worried about Africans moving up and consuming. It's really important for us as Africans to establish that our development is non-negotiable. All of those decades of exploitation and being left behind that is owed to us." Rose Mutiso cited a 2019 study that estimated electricity demand from the gaming industry in California alone would grow from 5 terawatt hours in 2011 to as much as 11 terawatt hours by 2021, the same as Sri Lanka's entire electricity consumption. Meanwhile, electricity could be delivered to more than a billion people currently living without it within a decade by linking up small-scale projects into a giant environmentally friendly network. According to a new global commission, advances in microenergy grids and renewable energy technologies could dramatically accelerate change and transform lives in rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa and also in South Asia. The Global Commission to End Energy Poverty met for the first time recently to set out plans to accelerate the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal to ensure access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy for all the peoples of the world by 2030. The commission, established by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative and the Rockefeller Foundation, plans to bring together leading investors, utilities, and policymakers to tackle energy poverty. Under the initiative, the distributed networks would help connect homes, businesses, and schools to small-scale solar power projects to deliver cheap, sustainable electricity that can help power local economic growth. The commission includes government leaders, energy industry chief executives, and representatives from major development organizations. Dr. Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and formerly of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said, "A whole new way of thinking about energy distribution was required." Dr. Rajiv Shah said, "We cannot end poverty without successfully ending energy poverty. For 140 years, we've had this mindset that energy access means building big power plants and connecting them to national grids, and that's how you provide electricity." Dr. Rajiv Shah noted, "Today, new technology frontiers, business models, and our knowledge of alternatives is so strong that this commission will be able to set out a new roadmap to end the energy access problem for 1 billion people across the globe." The Commission also plans to help set up new regulation in developing countries to accelerate the rollout of new energy systems and make the projects more attractive to international investors. Dr. Rajiv Shah explained, "If I want to start a small solar-powered mini-grid program in a rural part of an underserved country, I could be prevented from actually providing power without permission from the state-owned utility, which might own that business opportunity. That's one of the many policy roadblocks that is preventing distributed solutions from really being easy to invest in." Dr. Rajiv Shah will co-chair the commission alongside Dr. Ernest Moniz, a former U.S. Energy Secretary, and Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, the President of the African Development Bank. Dr. Ernest Moniz warned that existing plans to end global energy poverty by 2030 are not fast enough and should be more ambitious. He said, 20 years ago, energy access might have been defined by having a 20-watt light bulb. One doesn't want to denigrate that. The shift from having no light to some light is major, but our ambition is more than that. We want energy access that allows for credible family, community, and regional economic development. Frankly, we'd like it to allow for entrepreneurial activity as well. Dr. Moniz said that by relying on renewable energy, particularly solar power, alongside batteries, developing nations should be able to attract investment in clean energy and rule out the need for future investments in coal-fired power plants. He said adapting such methods could also halt the wood burning that has led to mass deforestation in some countries.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr al-Din, Muhammad il-Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of miscellaneous nature, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Halli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Halli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sir Shawid, let me ask you at the beginning of this episode about tattoo. Lots of people are very much fond of it, and you can see it everywhere. It's becoming a household term now. What is the status of tattoo according to Ayatollah Sistani?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tattoos are generally permissible. According to all religious authorities, tattoos are allowed, you know. There might be some scholars who might be opposed to the modern the new forms of tattoos that are that we see on a daily basis when we have encounters with different people. You know, we see different designs, different shapes, and some of those designs are really, we can say, offensive to some people.
Yes.
But as a general criterion, Ayatollah Sistani says that tattoos are allowed. It was allowed in the early period of Islam, and it is still allowed. So Islam does not or has not changed. You know, the religious authorities have no reason to change the law of the Islam, the law, the legal code of practice.
Mm-hmm.
So tattoos are permissible. Now, there are some questions maybe popping up to your mind, to everybody's mind, whether tattoos, tattoos of any kind are permissible. For example, there are different designs and shapes, and of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that tattoos are permissible even if a person wants to tattoo a loin or the image of a loin or an animal. But it is reprehensible.
I see.
For a person to get the images of an animal or an animate being, whether a human being, whether an insect, whether a loin, whether a jackal or something like that, tattooed on his body.
I see.
Because
it's not haram, but it's
not
reprehensible.
Haram. It's reprehensible. It's makruh. And therefore, when someone, let's say, offers his prayer, he will have the tattoo on his fingers or maybe on his shoulders. So this makes the prayer makruh, because he has the picture of an animal on his arm, and of course.
What about tattooing the image of the opposite sex?
The same is the case. The position is the same. You know, it's not permissible. It's makruh. It's not haram. It's not haram, but it's makruh to have the picture of a woman tattooed on your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Sheikh Javid, you refer to the early period of Islam where tattoo was not considered unlawful, basically,
yes.
And the trend is still the same, right?
You're
so
right.
The jurisprudential status of Ayatollah Sistani about tattoo is the same. So you said that it's halal, it's permissible, right? So it's not haram. But doesn't it depend on the method
For example, in the early periods of Islam, or even before Islam, they used to do it with a special kind of, what do you call it, devices.
Needles?
Or needles. But now they do it like in different ways. Doesn't it depend on that? The methodology doesn't change their status?
The method has changed substantially.
All right.
In modern time, probably they don't use the needles that Muslims used to use in the early period of Islam. They are using new devices. Mm-hmm. Okay. But let me tell you, the Shia Muslims are unfortunately under the impression of the Sunni, majority Sunni Muslims. According to Sunni Muslims, tattoos are forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Tattoos are forbidden. And therefore, many Shia Muslims think that tattoos are forbidden. Why do the Sunni Muslims forbid tattoos? Because they think that it's a kind of changing the shape and the figure of someone. Let's say you put tattoos on your skin,
mm-hmm.
and it's a kind of changing your skin, and because Allah the Almighty has given you, a very nice,
delicate skin,
and you're changing it.
Mm-hmm.
You're changing God's creation.
Yes.
This is the excuse brought up by Sunnis,
mm-hmm.
and that's why they have made it haram. But the Shia religious authorities are of the view that tattoos are forbidden, are halal. They are halal, and that is not considered to be a changing God's creation.
Yes.
You know.
Okay.
It is permissible, and it does not form a kind of barrier to water during wudu and
ghusl. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker in the studio with us. We were talking about tattoo and the jurisprudential status of tattoo according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani. And Sheikh Javid, before the break, you said that although the Sunni scholars in fact made it unlawful and haram, or announced it as a haram act, Shiite religious authorities don't think, or they are not of the same opinion. So they think that tattoos were halal or permissible in the early period of Islam, and the rule didn't change so far.
Sure.
And when we are talking about the jurisprudential status, we are not concerned with the social etiquette or the social code of conduct. Basically,
you're right.
Maybe you cannot carry a tattoo to work because if you are showing it, for example, it's on your skin, and if you have a job of a high status, for example, it's kind of beneath you, you know, socially speaking or culturally speaking. But this is the way the jurisprudence, in fact, rules about the tattoo according to the Shiite scholars, right?
You're right.
And religious authorities. But the other question that I wanted to ask you in this episode is that, of course, you implied it before the break, very shortly, at a quick reference. Is the tattoo the preventer of, for example, wuzu?
Yeah. Tattoos do not form an obstruction,
mm-hmm.
and they do not impede, they do not form an impediment.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you do not need to remove tattoos. And of course, tattoos, removing tattoos is an uphill, is a difficult task, you know.
Right.
Tattoos do not go away even if you wait for them to go away. So you don't have to worry if you have tattoos on your skin.
Yes.
They are not going to affect your wudu, and they are not going to you affect your ghusl and your prayer at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. How about the women? We know that lots of women, in fact, they perform and they have the tattoos, in fact, performed on their bodies. And could they, in fact, show that to a non-mahram, or they have to keep it hidden?
Generally speaking, women should not uncover their ornaments and their adornments,
yes,
beautification, to non-mahram men, you know, to men, to strangers, when they are in public places, or when they are when they may be seen by men who are not related to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it is mandatory for women to cover their beauties, to cover their adornments.
Thank you very much. Thank you, dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio. We hope you enjoyed this show, and we leave you in Allah's care. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
The day he started his presidential campaign, US President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the US goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continue between Tehran and the P4+1 group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are back-ordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty, okay? They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world, and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing. It's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.